This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Helen Farmer with you. I hope you're well. On today's episode, a bit of a health special in various forms. Dr. Shefali Verma was with us as we talked about wearables, how does a doctor deal with jet lag, and how to get a better sleep tonight. Putting colon cancer under the spotlight, we had Dr. Neil with us from Health Bay Polyclinic, and also speaking to two gentlemen who have had investigations from precancerous polyps to being 4 years in remission from colon cancer. Plus, it was husband and wife team Farah and Dinesh who shared their experiences of bringing up their boy on the spectrum and how Dubai is more autism friendly than you might think. Dr. Shefali Verma is an integrated medicine specialist, and we are talking today about sleep hygiene, wearable, taking your questions. If you are feeling a bit under the weather as well, get in touch. How are you, Doctor?
I'm obviously better than you are.
I know. Do you know what it is? You know when you know, and you just go, I'm sick now.
You're not well.
No, I went to bed on Tuesday night and woke up at how tragic is this? I went to bed and woke up again at 11 o'clock. That's how early I went to bed, and was like, oh no. And then yes, I had a shocking headache. So I'm glad you're here, because you said actually if something else was on my wrist right now, I might have anticipated the fact I was getting sick. How can wearables predict the future?
Actually, it's become so interesting. I remember when I got COVID, I had a Whoop and my Oura Ring on at the time, and both of them picked up a temperature rise by 0.2. At least I think that was my Oura. My heart rate went up, but so did my respiratory rate. And that was even before I lost the taste and smell, before I got sick.
So this is you as a doctor who obviously is far more tuned in than the vast majority of people to these things. When you're saying you get an alert, does it tell you that your temperature's gone up by 0.2 degree? Or are you looking on that graph and going, interesting, my heart rate's increased, respiratory rate has changed, temperature's gone up, that could mean that I'm getting sick?
So, you know, over the last, like, whatever, 4 or 5 years, and the Oura Ring I've had for several years now, they've actually come up with the next generation and the next generation. And I think they've actually improved a lot. So before, you would notice. Now they also do alert you, but it doesn't come like an alarm or anything like that. You have to look at your data and it might pick up. But they have like inbuilt sort of quote-unquote coaches on the Whoop as well that might say, look, you know, how are you? Or and they ask you a question when you look at your data and it'll be like, what happened last night? And then sometimes you have to fill in a journal. You know, journals of, you know, did you do this? Did you do that? And I think these things are quite interesting for people to have an ability to look at their data. Obviously, it's data, but it's also very important for you to not be one of those people who get scared with data. So
well,
it's, you
that,
have to find that, comfort.
That balance was kind of wrong for me. And I just found like I ended up just overanalyzing the data and looking at the numbers rather than looking at how I was feeling.
And what did you have?
I had a Fitbit, which was looking at sleep. So, and this is a few years ago. To be honest with you, no disrespect to Fitbit, I think I've had three and they've all packed up. They haven't been that great. And the sleep one was like, Helen, you have had, you know, 6 hours of sleep and you should be feeling like garbage today. And I'd wake up and go, I feel pretty good today. And then I'd look at the data and go, I should be feeling like garbage. And then that would bring my energy and my mood down. So that would then dictate, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Do you feel like COVID has been a bit of a turning point in us owning our data and being a bit more tuned into it?
Yeah, you know, actually, that's a really, really good question. I do think more and more people from then, whether it is because of that time or people had more time to think about all my 8 daily multipliers during that time where you're housebound and you're looking at how can I make myself healthier, because ultimately, you know, COVID could affect anybody. They might have then invested in these trackers to be able to be on top of their data, whether it is because or not, or the timing just was right. But now I think there are a lot more people. And then people who did well, so Whoop did amazingly well during that time. And now they're like just everybody's got them. And they, you know, obviously have done really well at that time. More and more people are wearing them, more and more people are looking to have them. And ultimately, if you are not made sick by looking at this amount of data, because obviously there are people who will look at it and then be like, nervous about not being able to fall asleep mm-hmm. because now tomorrow their WHOOP is going to say they're in the red zone. And, you know, they're already thinking of these things that haven't happened. So it gives
things
them all this
anxiety.
Yeah. And then they get this anxiety, which then ultimately worsens their sleep. That's not for them.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Shefali with us today. Are you wearing a wearable? Let me know. We're live this afternoon, 4001. Do you like it? Are you not? So fussed. My daughter was asking me about getting a wearable. Interestingly, we were with some friends yesterday and we were like, oh, we'll meet you in half an hour. So we put my friend's Apple Watch on her daughter and she was like, oh, I love it. And she's like 8. Mm. And they're asking about getting them. I was like, is that a useful thing? You know,
I don't think they need an Apple one at that time.
Not at that price.
But, you know, my kids, I did buy them, you know, sort of, you know, cheaper versions of them. And during that time, obviously, because they are cheaper, they don't have the longevity as like some of the, you know, high tech ones that mm-hmm. are more expensive. But during that time, they're aware of their steps, how many steps they did. And I think that that's not a bad thing, mm-hmm. you know, to be active in a place that here where walking is not such a big thing.
I always feel a bit like I don't really need one because I'm not an athlete. I'm not looking to boost my performance, you know. So I guess my question is, how do you decide which wearable is for you?
How do you decide that you're not an athlete?
I haven't done any exercise in about 3 weeks, Shefali.
Okay, well, but in general, I think, again, the definition of an athlete or whatever, they're all, you know, they all start off, we're all start off the same. I actually did a post on that just recently, that we're all athletes to an extent. I mean, you're here, you're working, you know, everybody else is off. It's all
very generous.
No, but ultimately, still, how you sleep, how many steps you get in, how are your daily multipliers and how many of them are you doing is very relevant when it comes to tracking those things. It's not just for exercise. Mm-hmm. In fact, the Oura Ring and now the Ultra Human Air were actually designed, well, the Oura Ring originally was the only thing that was designed to track recovery.
Interesting. And how do the gadgets, to your mind, adapt to men and women? We think about, you know, us having very specific and very different needs. I mean, could you be looking at temperature increases, you know, because of hormones,
100%,
for example?
And that will be picked up in the Oura Ring that measures your temperature and possibly your heart rate. You might know. So for people, for example, fertility, they don't have like regular periods. And, you know, they might actually see, oh, this is my temperature is rising at this point. Maybe now I'm in ovulation. Maybe this is the time. Like, I do think there's a lot of positive things that can come through that. But obviously with the temperature rise and the effect of sleep, maybe just premenstrually, you kind of know the time that you're coming out. And you can log those things too. So I think there's a lot of things that you can now, you know, integrate with other sort of softwares on your sort of like watch or as in your phone, and, you know, collecting a lot of data together on one gadget.
Jet lag. How does a doctor deal with it?
Well, I don't know about other doctors, but I'll tell you how I deal with it. And having my children, because obviously, you know, we flew in, we probably got home around 2.
A.M.
A.M. And the kids were actually on UK time, obviously, which is 3 hours. And they were sleeping super late. Okay. So initially, I knew that the first night was going to be, we were going to be sleeping sort of early morning. I actually woke up probably around midday after having only about 6 hours of broken sleep. Mm-hmm. So the first day I kind of let the children sleep because I don't want them to get sick because they're run down. That would be 2 days of like fatiguey, travel-y, whatever. But today they still slept at, relatively at an 8 o'clock UK time yesterday, which is around 11. But they both woke up around sort of 9-ish, mm-hmm. which was better than, you know. In terms of eating, though, we try and not have them eat too late. So I would still try and follow the normal sleep hygiene to try and optimize being able to sleep. Because jet lag by itself, you're on a different time zone. So that's the one of the uncontrollable factors.
Now, I cannot sleep on planes. I look over at my husband and he is basically unconscious before the seatbelt sign comes off. It's a very quick way to consider divorce. I'm not gonna lie. Between airport dad and sleeping on the plane,
I didn't sleep at all.
We don't travel together very well at all.
Yeah.
Does sleeping on the plane help with jet
lag? It depends on where you're going, obviously. Now, I feel like if, for example, you're going for 3 or 4 days somewhere, it's kind of like not long enough. Can you kind of, you know, change or create or maintain the same sort of schedule depending on how far you're going? I think that's very important. Mm-hmm. So eating times kind of create your circadian rhythm wherever you are. Like I've talked about this before, carbohydrates and white meats at night you know, encourage sleep, whereas red meat, caffeine, the energetic stuff shouldn't be really had at that time. So following wherever you go, I think it's really important. But if you're sleeping on a plane and it's not the red eye, like if you're sleeping in the day, when you get to the other side, you're also going to be, you know, struggling.
Yeah.
And you've got to ask the question, a person that can sleep, and I'm not talking about your husband, but in general, a person who can sleep, you know, wake up and then sleep on the plane again and then sleep when they come back. It's like, well, that's kind of almost too much. And are you really having the quality of sleep on a plane? You might be closing your eyes, you might be resting, might be a lot of light sleep, but are you actually asleep? Maybe not.
Two things I want to come back to. You mentioned sleep hygiene there, which I think means different things to different people. Would you mind explaining your definition of sleep hygiene? And I guess your, and we're talking about at home, away from jet lag, on a normal night, what do you believe we should all be doing, changing, removing in terms of habit and environment?
So in clinic, when I have a discussion with someone about trying to optimize their sleep, it all starts off with sort of their routine before bed. So obviously, you know, when it comes to the further away from your bedtime, that's where you kind of put off your, you know, your laptop, you stop looking at these sort of the blue light, wearing blue light blocking glasses, choosing what you're choosing to sleep, watch on TV. I mean, if you're going to start watching crime and suspense and thrillers, then it's really hard to be winding down at that time. So what you sleep, what you're watching, blue light blocking glasses. But when you sleeping and having a hot shower or bath before bed actually raises the temperature then, and then it cools you down. That cooling of the body and the core temperature actually prepares the body to go to sleep. Sleeping in a cold environment, and I'm talking really 18 to 20 degrees.
That's really cold. Correct.
Most people will argue, but we are designed to sleep and maintain that cold temperature and then cocoon yourself, right? So then
all the blankets.
Yeah, exactly. And then that actually keeps you cozy, comforted. Heavy blankets actually make a big difference than those light sort of sheets, pitch black. You're not designed to sleep in light. Light and melatonin, there's a correlation, melatonin being the hormone to put you to sleep. So that's also very important. So having these night lights, because kids feel, is really creating a bad habit for the children. They are designed to sleep pitch black, cold, pitch black. What you eat before bed matters. Like I said, carbohydrates, white meats, you know, coffee, caffeine, all earlier in the day. You know, when you exercise makes a big difference. Mm-hmm. So earlier, if you're somebody who can't like sleep, you know, these are the things that if you do regularly in routine and having the same sleep time, the same wake up time.
Consistency.
Yeah, it's a clock.
Well, let's go to the text line. You mentioned melatonin earlier. Diana's saying how to use it and is it safe for kids, e.g. 9-year-olds? What is melatonin? How is it used in the body?
Okay. It's a hormone that is released really when the lights go down. That kind of encourages the gland to release melatonin to get you to fall asleep. It doesn't keep you asleep. You can wake up. Once you wake up, all the issues of not being able to sleep, you know. I think people use it far too easily, far too much. Apparently, like one of my mentors told me that we produce, I think, something like 0.35 milligrams, I think it is. But here, people are taking 3, 5, 10 milligrams to fall asleep. So it's a hormone. Do I think it's safe? No, I don't. I remember learning also that if you're not deficient in melatonin, you actually deplete serotonin, which is your happy neurotransmitter. Mm. So again, I'm not saying that it is bad for everybody. You know, I have used it when I have traveled to LA and I'm on a different time zone and I have to be talking at a conference or being at a conference and I need to fall asleep. But often I feel rubbish in the morning. And if I wake up in the middle of the night, it is very difficult for me to fall asleep.
Okay.
Do I think kids need it? Well, no, I don't really. The question becomes, well, can we look at all the common things first before giving anyone and anybody, whether you're young or not, a hormone?
Good point. We're saving you money this afternoon, guys. 4001. Staying in that vein, actually, an anonymous message. And you can always leave your names off. That's fine. Saying, I had my usual, I don't know if this is a thing, pre-period insomnia. last night. Magnesium doesn't work then. Is it worth taking another supplement, e.g. calcium, to help sleep? I can't find very much information about it.
Actually, it's a very good question. So yes, it is very common for the night before you get your period or the premenstrual sort of few days for your sleep to be disrupted. And often that is because of the drop in progesterone. Progesterone is our hormone that actually is our natural sleep aid. That's why we feel down, because it is also our happy hormone. So sometimes magnesium alone will not work, especially if you are a regular user of magnesium. Mm-hmm. Sometimes magnesium and B6 combination actually helps people go to sleep. And sometimes, depending on what you're eating, and also sometimes I think people are needing to eat more before, so they're actually not eating enough. You could have a lot more carbs before you go to bed and those kind of things that can actually help your sleep. But also temperature rises, so that can affect your sleep before your period. So again, making sure your room is cold, maybe do everything a little bit more diligently in your premenstrual sort of times, can aid you go to sleep. There are other supplements, but, you know, it really is dependent on that person. I don't think they're, you know.
It's really interesting. Didn't know it was a thing.
Yeah.
Aren't we lucky as women? Just so many different things going on.
Right. Well, I mean, obviously, that's not something that you suffer from.
No, there clearly, you go. Clearly.
Very good.
Dr. Shefali with us today. Talking earlier about sleep patterns, jet lag, what about this post-Ramadan period? Ida said, this has just come through on my social media, saying, my husband's been sleeping most afternoons through Ramadan and now Eid, then going to bed at 1 a.m, which wakes me up. I want to offer some advice for getting him back to normal before Monday.
Look, I definitely think if you're sleeping more than 30 to 40 minutes during the day, that will often ruin anybody's sleep. The body, once you have a certain amount of sleep, it actually doesn't know, is it night or day, because you've sleep deep, and if it's over a period of time. 30 minutes, a power nap can re-energize you, but you shouldn't be almost catching up in the day, because it's harder to get. It would be best for him to decrease slowly the amount of sleep that he has in the afternoon.
Okay, so we're Thursday now, so that's doable. If you're sleeping for, you know, 2 hours, to be reducing it by half an hour a day.
And I think, you know what, to have one rubbish morning to then have a better day, you know what, go with it.
Okay, good advice. Good question. Thank you, Ida. Dr. Shefali with us today. If you've got any questions about sleep, you can reach out. James messaged earlier saying, are some people just night owls? Our sons are 2 years apart, but have totally different sleep patterns. And I said earlier, you can send in your symptoms. Jill, sounds a bit like me, been feeling terrible since Sunday. I can't face food. I want to sleep all the time. Went to bed at 8 o'clock last night, woke up feeling exhausted. My husband's on at me to get to the doctor, but I can't face the effort of getting up and dressed. Any ideas? Jill, fear not. We have got your back. James says, and I think the idea of sleep chronotypes is a really interesting topic. Mm. He says, are some people just night owls? Our two sons are 2 years apart and have completely different sleep patterns.
You know, I read about that a couple of days ago, it being, you know, that they are totally different and it's hard to get them on the same sleep schedule. And then it's harder for one to wind down. There is, and I think it does follow through all the way through. But I still think that over time, I think it's important to not create stress consistently trying to get two boys on the same schedule if it's not happening, because that just changes family dynamics.
It can. It can also become a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy as well, being like, oh, you're a night owl and you're an early, and, you know, start to kind of conform to those stereotypes as well. I don't know. What would you say you are?
Ooh, you know, I've never been a really good sleeper. I never was growing up. And I think after the children and actually getting into functional medicine and looking at how can I optimize, it has got so much better. Mm. But after the children, you know, and trying to be sort of being able to work and train and be a parent, I think I have gotten to like a normalish, you know, quote unquote, schedule where
I do too, but you kind of, for a while, when the children are young, you feel like that's never going to happen. So I just want to say to the new parents listening, and when I say new, that can be anything from like a week old to 3 years old. I was on hyper alert for years, just half an ear listening out for a squawk. And now you know, my kids are still early risers. They'll come in at, you know, 5:45 for a bit of a chat and do the Wordle with me in bed and things. But I never thought we'd get to a stage where we would have an unbroken night's sleep. So my message is really, it does get better.
It does get better.
I promise it does get better. Last question. This is from Jill. Jill, as you might be able to hear from my voice, I sympathise. Jill says, I've been feeling terrible since Sunday. It's not a rotten thing to feel terrible during Eid as well. Saying, can't face food, just want to sleep all the time. Went to bed at 8 o'clock last night and still woke up feeling exhausted. My husband is on at me to go to the doctor, but I can't even face the effort of getting up and getting dressed. So since you're on the radio, I wanted to ask, any ideas?
I mean, I definitely think you need to go see a doctor, but you might become, you most definitely are coming down with something if this is something that you don't experience often. And if you're normally somebody who wakes up and has a lot of energy and you don't, that is a change for you. You might not have a bacterial infection, but you could definitely be coming down with a virus. And often they will get better by themselves. But I think it's good to stop guessing. And I think we all tend to, like, you know, try and treat ourselves the whole time. But yes, sometimes it is worth just having someone, you know, check, make sure, have you got temperature? You know, look at all those things. But if you're tired and you're, you know, needing rest, I think it is good to rest. So don't try and, you know, do everything else that you shouldn't be doing. Have other people help you. Let them be aware that you actually need rest and you cannot do it. Otherwise, it's going to take you even longer to recover. But, you know, obviously, if you have access and you can go see a doctor, I mean, I think that it is worth doing that as opposed to, you know.
Okay. I'll go after work.
Yes. We already had this discussion. That we do think it might be worth you going to see someone after.
All right. Jill, please feel better. I'm glad we were able to help you out this afternoon. 4001 is the number to message us all the way through until 5 o'clock. Dr. Shefali, for anyone that wants to contact you, find out what you've been up to, looking at performance, looking at wellness, what's the best way to reach out?
So I'm in clinic as well, but you can reach out on my Instagram, which is Dr. Chef with the word doctor spelled out, as well as my website, drshefali.com. So yeah,
thank you.
Hear from you.
Thank you for coming in. Eid Mubarak to you and yours.
To you.
Have a good night's sleep tonight.
Yes.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Last month was Colon Cancer Awareness Month, and we are a little bit late on marking it, but I think this next hour will be so, so valuable to so many people listening today, whether you are a survivor, maybe you want some more information, maybe someone in your family who's had a diagnosis. And joining us in studio now, we've got Heini, in remission for colon cancer for 4 years now. He's a veteran voiceover artist and a production manager of our sister station around the corner, Tag 91.1. I'm always want to say, how are you? But I guess I really mean, how are you? How are you, Heini?
I'm doing great. Hi, Helen. I'm doing great. When you have it, I mean, C, when you have C, or you have like cancer, things come into perspective. So, you know, you have that, like, do you do good or do you just dive into, you know, whatever happens, happens?
So that's an interesting perspective. And actually, a friend of mine said something very similar recently, which was, she had breast cancer and she's been in remission for about 3 years now. And she said that actually, before she got her diagnosis, it was breast cancer that she had. She said she felt quite lost. Mm-hmm. And it gave her a bit of a purpose, gave her a bit of a mission. And I think that word perspective is, I mean, my goodness, let's take some positive from a really horrendous situation. Can you tell us a little bit about the origin story, I guess? You know, what were some of your early signs of colon cancer, Heini?
So with my diagnosis, it basically just happened out of nowhere. I had no signs whatsoever. It doesn't run in my family. I was already working out. I mean, prior to the diagnosis, so basically I got my surgery on October 17, 2020. It's one of those dates you'll never forget in your entire life, you know. Mm. So I got diagnosed October 17, 2020.
So COVID year, brilliant.
Yeah, I know. Right. And then 2 years before that, I've been already working out, eating healthy, whole foods, all the whole works.
Tick, tick, tick.
Right.
Feeling smug.
Yeah. And then just out of nowhere, like my stomach starts to ache. And I was like, this is weird. It's a different kind of sensation. You know, it would happen like in spasms of like every 15 to 30 minutes. And I was like, this is different. It's not my usual stomach ache, you know? Mm. And then it happened from like, I was having that pain the night before and I couldn't sleep because it was so painful.
So every 15 to 30 minutes? Mm-hmm.
It was like, it's not really a pulsating pain. It was like, like my entire stomach was like constricting. It was like trying to do something and I couldn't figure it out.
Were you presumably just necking Gaviscon?
Yeah. So I called my sister. She's in Virginia. So she stayed on the line with me for like hours. And then, you know, I was like, no, I think this will pass. And, you know, I think I just passed out of the pain. And then in the morning, I was like, it's still there. And it's like getting the bursts of the pain was like getting shorter and shorter.
Is that when you went to the hospital?
Yeah. And so I drove myself to the hospital, to the ER. And then the doctor was telling me, you have a blockage in your intestines. So there are two things that we can do here. We're going to let you drink 3 bottles of this liquid dye. And either it's going to flush it out, whatever that blockage is, or we'll have to like open you up and, you know,
have a look.
Yeah, look what's under, you know, underneath the hood.
Presumably, it was option B for you. Nothing got flushed out. Or did something get flushed out?
So I was hoping something would get flushed out.
But
you're
sweet release.
Right.
No.
No, I just, you know those Somali kids with like, they're really skinny and their stomachs are really bloated? That's what happened to me. Because it wasn't going anywhere.
So you did a series of tests at that point.
They gave me
super bloated, and then what investigations did they do?
They did an ultrasound on me and some other. It wasn't an X-ray; it's a different kind of like a CT scan or something like that. And everyone was like really quiet, so it was making me really nervous, you know.
Gosh.
So they said, "Okay, we're gonna admit you now to the hospital. We'll put you under observation." And okay, so like the next day, they tell me, "Okay, this is what's gonna happen." It wasn't my initial doctor. It was like his student doctor or something.
In an ideal world, you would like it from your official doctor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So
she was like giving me like, you know, like, hi, how are you doing? She was giving me the pep talk. And then out of nowhere, she just tells me, okay, this is what's going to happen. Because tomorrow is like a Friday, so there are no doctors. So we'll operate you first thing on Saturday morning. I was like, why can't you operate on me now? Because nobody's going to be here. Okay, great. I guess I'll just have to hang on, right?
I'll just be alone with my thoughts for the next 36 hours. That's going to be emotionally healthy. When did they tell you it was cancer, honey?
They didn't. So the student doctor told me, like, we're going to operate on you and there are going to be risks here. And then I joked. I'm like, oh, come on. You're not telling me I'm going to die, right? And she just remains quiet. I was like, you're kidding, right? This is a joke, right? And she just like doesn't say anything.
Oh, crap.
And that was like the weirdest silence ever.
Yeah, can I speak to your supervisor? can I get some answers, please?
And so she walks out, and my wife talks to her, and then my wife comes in, and she's also quiet. I'm like, what's going on? Tell me. So nobody tells me whatsoever. They only tell me minutes before my surgery.
And then you're like, give me the drugs. I want to be unconscious immediately. How long was your surgery, honey?
It was for 6 hours.
And how much of your intestine did they remove?
They took out like 2/3 of my intestines, like a full arm's length.
Gosh.
Mm-hmm.
So after the surgery, then you presumably got more information, which was that you had colon cancer. What stage?
It was stage 2, bordering to 3. And they searched all my lymph nodes. They didn't find anything there. They just found it. Because there are different like signs, major signs, that it's a major indicator, and that it was the blockage. Mm-hmm. So basically, they showed me like the scans, and I saw it right there in my intestines. It was like it blocked, and everything like jam packed, and everything got bloated
around it.
Yeah, because it was, you know, it wasn't going anywhere. It was just stockpiling.
Was it a case of we've removed this? Now you can go home, everything's golden. Or did you then have to have chemo and follow-up therapies?
So basically they said, like, since they removed that and they checked, like, nearly all of the lymph nodes, like, they were saying, like, you're like 80% clear. Because whenever they find that you have cancer, you don't know. Like, it could be microscopic. It could be dormant for several years. Mm-hmm. And it just pops up, like, out of nowhere. So they said, they gave me like, okay, we would advise you to take chemo. Since you're young and you're working out and all that.
Yeah, you're healthy enough to take it.
We suggest you do the full shebang. I'm like, what do you mean, full shebang?
Treat yourself to a bit of chemo. So yeah, you had 6 months?
Yeah, let's do 6 months and do it every 2 weeks.
Gosh. Did you keep working during this time?
Yeah.
Wow, honey.
Yeah.
And how did it affect you? Because my dad's had colon cancer and he actually had treatment in Dubai.
Oh.
And I found it really interesting to see how chemo affects people in different ways. Like he ended up staying with me for the odd night when he was having the treatment. And I know it depends on the type of chemo, but he didn't lose his hair. He kept working. He wanted to go to Adventure HQ and buy an inflatable kayak. And I was like, Dad, I think maybe you just come home and rest a little bit. How did it affect you?
I know for those who don't know what chemo feels like, it's something you don't want to go through. I'm telling you. It's like, especially the first two sessions, mm-hmm. it feels like you're melting. It feels like the planet is dragging your entire body to the ground. And not only that, you have a fever, you have like a headache, a migraine, like everything. And it's happening. Even in your sleep, it's happening. You wake up from the pain. And then you're like, you know, you have those moments where you're like, can you just put me out of my misery? This mm-hmm. is excruciating
pain. It's not
worth it. Yeah. So I had to like endure. I mean, when you get to like the fourth one, you're kind of fine and you're kind of defeated.
I'm emotionally prepared for it a little. Oh, you said you're defeated.
Yeah, it really gets you, you know, like when you pass like the sixth one, because the 6 months, is basically that's a total of like 12 sessions. Mm-hmm. When you get to like the fifth or sixth, you're like, I don't really care now, you know, like, I don't know where I'm going, but let's just keep on going. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it becomes really hard when you're, because I voice, right? Whenever I voice, I'm like gassed for the day.
Totally out of breath and exhausted.
Yeah. And if I have my first meal, whatever it is, like even if it's like a handful of peanuts, I have to sleep. I could feel like my heart pulsating. Like slowly. And then I tell the office, I tell the guys here, like, okay, I could feel it. I'm going to have a shutdown. Mm-hmm. So they'd give me like 3 to 6 hours to sleep. And then I'd wake up and like at night, and I'd say, okay, then I resume making the commercials or whatever promos.
Tiny. And how are you now? How is your health? What's the day-to-day implications of having 2/3 of your intestines removed?
Well, the good thing is, I was telling you off air, I'm never constipated.
Every cloud has a silver lining. Yeah, happy days. Yeah. Efficient.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I saw the cancer scene here. It's really, you know, it gives you a different perspective. I mean, a lot of people are aware of cancer, but when you really have it, it puts a lot of things into, you know, like perspective. Like you appreciate things more. Mm-hmm. You see things in a different light. You're lucky to be alive. And I mean, I saw people who are far worse than I am. I had talks with them, and it was a lot of tears because I could place myself in their shoes.
And people who don't make it.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I'm so glad that you're here to tell your story today.
Oh, thank you.
And here with humor and grace and inspiration. Thank you so, so much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
You're going to have a chat with our doctor in the green room. You can talk all things colon in a minute. Heine in the studio, as we said, he's been in remission for 4 years. So 5 years is the golden number, right?
Yeah. After five, you're like,
boom, I'm a survivor.
Yeah.
That's what we're going for. Heine, an absolute pleasure. Thank you so, so much. Up next, we are going to be catching up with Michael, actually a patient of Dr. Neil from Health Bay, who is joining us after 5:30. Just been hearing from Heine there, who is 4 years in remission for colon cancer, and some lovely messages coming through saying, what a guy, great attitude. We've got Dr. Neil from Health Bay joining us in about 10 minutes' time. So if you've got any questions for him, you're more than welcome to reach out. We've got Michael with us now. He works for a shipping company here in the UAE. And I'm pretty sure you become an expert pretty fast in all things colon cancer once you start having some conversations with a doctor like Dr. Neil. Michael, how are you?
I'm very fine. Thank you very much indeed. And thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. I think it's such an important conversation to be hearing, because we can talk about numbers. We can talk about stats. But I think it's so much more impactful, important to hear people who have had those conversations, who have been sat across the desk and thought, what does this mean for me? What does this mean for my family? So what tests did you do? What prompted you to get tested, Michael?
Well, I mean, I've been doing some general health tests, and my father, more than 20 years ago, had a triple bypass, and I knew that, you know, it could run in the family. And I do have, a bit of high blood pressure and cholesterol, and then, you know, check it up. And then you sort of do the full thing there. And then the doctor very rightly pointed out that at my age, it was perhaps good to go for a colonoscopy.
Which, and, you know, no one welcomes this. No one's like, oh, I can't wait to go for a colonoscopy.
No, exactly. Exactly. And
however,
and again, I mean,
doing it.
I've heard about it, but I didn't know a lot about it. And as you said, you know, you become a sort of an expert very, very quickly. So, yeah, I didn't hesitate or I didn't think too much about it because, good. You know, just imagine you said no and something was there. And I mean, I've grown up where, you know, the slogan was always that the cancer you discover in time can be healed. So I feel it's important. That's, of course, also why I'm here today. I mean, it is an important subject, and I think especially for men.
I completely agree. So there were stool tests, a colonoscopy for colon cancer screening, and they found potentially precancerous polyps. That must have been a tricky thing to hear. What did treatment look like? You had surgery?
No, I did not. So they did the colonoscopy, and the colonoscopy itself is they do it differently around the world, but this was my first time. But I spoke to quite a few friends and so on who had it done. But here you're fully out, so you don't feel a thing. Mm-hmm. The next thing you know is what's Dr. Neil was saying. Say, okay, they performed this. They remove these polyps. And they do believe, as you say, that these can be the reason that you get cancer if they're not removed. Mm-hmm. So he said they removed it all, and he said that offhand he thought they were fine, but they of course test them and send them in. So I would say the next week until you get the call back I'm you know, fairly good at saying to myself, no, it's nothing. But when Dr. Neil called me and said, no, it all looked good. But because there was quite a few, he would recommend that I do another test and another colonoscopy in about a year's time. He said, yeah. It's not because I have to do it every year, but just to make sure that they're not coming back fast. So
peace of mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
Stay
so I'm going to do
stay
that.
Stay on top
yeah.
of it. Well, and how are you feeling today? How is your health?
No, my health is fine.
Good.
Absolutely, and you know it's one thing, of course, what you have and don't have, but your mental health and the knowledge that this at least has been checked, and with a good result. But even if something had to be done, I mean, then I'm sure, and I've read about it, and I heard about it, that you know if you discover it in time, then it's something that can be healed and taken care of.
Wise
so
words
so
indeed.
I'm really glad that I did it. Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much. As I said, it's really important to hear these stories, and especially, you know, lovely happy ending. Stay on top of it. Look after yourself, for you and for yours. And we are going to be speaking to your doctor next. Michael, an absolute pleasure to catch up. Wishing you a lovely
pleasure
lovely
to be here.
Eid break. Michael Fenger speaking to us there. It is Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, who was talking there about Dr. Neil. He is the man himself in the studio. Dr. Neil Galletti, consultant in gastroenterology and hepatology at Health Bay Clinic. Before the news, we heard from two gentlemen, two real-life stories about their experiences, one to do with detecting precancerous polyps, and my colleague Heine, who is 4 years in remission from colon cancer. So we've brought in the expert. Colon Cancer Awareness Month was in March, but I strongly believe it's a conversation we should be having all year round, and I say that as a journalist, but also as someone whose dad had colon cancer, and it's something I'm really passionate about, that we get past the embarrassment, that we know what some of the red flags are in terms of early detection saves lives. So who better to guide us through this topic than Dr. Neil, consultant in gastroenterology and hepatology at Health Bay Clinic. How are you, Dr. Neil?
I'm very well, thank you. And thank you so much for inviting me to talk with you today.
My pleasure. I wanted to ask you, and you've been a doctor for decades, why did you want to focus on this area of medicine in particular?
Now, you know, when patients ask me this, I always tell them because I was bottom of my class at medical school. But actually, no, that's not the real reason at all. So gastroenterology, which involves, you know, stomachs, intestines, colons and liver disease, it's a really interesting mix of kind of academic, working out, you know, solving puzzles, what's going on, but also practical, like doing the endoscopies, having a look inside people's stomachs or inside people's bile ducts or inside people's colons, and then being able to do something about it. Like, you know, we heard from my patient earlier about finding those polyps, and, you know, we've got tools that we can can remove them. So it's not just having a look, it's being able to do something practical as well. So that combination really appealed to me.
This proactivity is so, so crucial. And I wanted to ask you about maybe some common misconceptions about colon cancer and perhaps even some common demographics, you know, groups of people that do need to be paying more attention to some symptoms. So while you have the microphone, what are some of the myths that you'd like to address or perhaps raise awareness around certain aspects of the disease?
Already. So I guess one of the most important messages that I really want to get across this afternoon is about screening. So that was the second guest you had that were, he felt perfectly fine. He didn't have any symptoms whatsoever. And his potentially precancerous polyps were detected because of a screening test. And screening is all about checking people who don't have any symptoms, looking for either early cancer, which is obviously much more curable than late stage cancer, or even better, looking for precancerous lesions, because if you treat those before they turn into a cancer, then you can potentially prevent colon cancer. Now, a lot of people sit there and think, well, you know, I'm fine, I don't have any symptoms, I don't have any family history, I don't need to have screening. And that's the one myth. If I can bust that one this afternoon, I'll be delighted. Because if you've got a colon, you're going to be at risk of developing colon cancer. The risk goes up as you get older, and the risk can go up with other things like having a family history. Mm-hmm. But you don't want to wait until you start getting symptoms to start getting checked. Now, of course, if you do get symptoms, if you get changes to your gut health, to your digestive system that you can't explain, of course you should come along and have a chat and get tested. But screening is for people who don't have any symptoms, who are well, so we can keep them well.
Such wise words. Can we talk about the embarrassment factor? You know, as Michael said earlier, no one's like, oh, I can't wait to have a colonoscopy. We should just say, I'm sure nothing shocks you anymore. So we do need to put our embarrassment aside. When should we start screening? You said the risk can increase as we get older. Is there a milestone, a number that we need to be particularly tuned into?
So yeah, there are numbers. I mean, you know, historically we've always thought of colon cancer as being a disease of older age. And so a lot of countries gave 50 as the guideline to start screening. Now, over the last 20 years or so, we've seen a depressingly, we're seeing more and more cases in younger adults. So whereas maybe 20, 25 years ago, it was pretty unusual below the age of 50 to get colon cancer, now about one in five cases are being found in younger adults.
Gosh.
As with your first guest this morning, I think he was 40 when
That's
he was
right.
diagnosed. So in about 3-4 years ago in the US, they changed the screening guidelines to now start at the age of 45. Now, here in the UAE, it seems that colon cancer in younger adults is even more common. So the guidelines in the UAE would suggest at the age of 40. Now, the trouble is that creates a degree of confusion because you've got different countries with different guidelines. Some are still at 50, some are 45. UAE is saying 40. So, you know, I would certainly say by the age of 45, you ought to be having a think about it. And if there is a family history, if you've got a first degree relative, a father, a mother, a sister, a brother with colon cancer, then you should be having a chat with your doctor and thinking around the age of 40, or if your relative was diagnosed with cancer at an early age, even sooner to start then.
You mentioned before about, well, a few different risk factors. One is the family history, which to an extent we have absolutely no control over. One thing we do have control over is, as I said, being proactive and having those screenings and also having the knowledge of what's not quite right. Heine said before that he was getting, you know, really constrictive stomach pains, and he started it was the pain that really alerted him and got him to the hospital. Would you mind expanding on what we need to know around red flags and the colon?
Sure, of course. So, as I was saying earlier, probably the most important thing is that early colon cancer often doesn't necessarily cause any symptoms, or they can often be fairly mild and non-specific. But things that doctors usually recommend to look out for are the presence of blood, particularly if the blood's mixed in with the poop. I mean, hemorrhoids, piles can, of course, cause a little bit of bleeding on the paper afterwards. But if you're starting to see blood mixed in with the poop, then that suggests the blood's coming from higher up, and that's typically a red flag. The other thing thing we often recommend people look out for is a persistent, unexplained change to their bowel habit, particularly if their poop's getting a little bit more frequent or maybe a little bit softer than it usually is. And this has been going on for more than, you know, a couple of weeks. Then it's sensible to come and have a chat with either your GP, your family medicine doctor, or a gastroenterologist, and have any tests that may be helpful there. Now, as cancer gets bigger, if it starts to narrow the bowel, that can start to cause obstructive symptoms. It can start to cause the sort of pain that we heard about from your first guest. It can start to cause swelling of the abdomen, start to cause vomiting. But ideally, we want to be picking things up long before then.
Dr. Neil with us today. You mentioned before about the different ages of screenings, and actually here in the UAE, we sadly have higher numbers of colon cancer diagnosis in a younger age group. What about those lifestyle factors? How can we prevent colon cancer through what we eat, what we do, what we don't do?
Alrighty. So I would be definitely guilty of misinformation if I told anyone we can prevent colon cancer, but we can certainly reduce the risk of colon cancer. So we think the important, you know, the so-called lifestyle risk factors are things like the usual culprits: smoking, drinking too much alcohol, obesity, lack of physical activity. We also think that probably a diet with too much processed meat in it is bad for us. You know, your burgers, sausages, cured meats, things like that. And also there's some evidence that too much consumption of red meats can also be potentially slightly risky. Whereas things like staying physically active, which is of course great for our health in all sorts of ways, seems to be protective. Having a diet high in whole grains or natural fibres can also be really, really useful.
To come back to the testing, which I think is really important. So let's say there have been some red flags, and that might be, you know, as you're talking about consistency or frequency or pain. What would you be doing at Health Bay to initially start the investigations?
So, you know, with medicine, it's very, very individualised. It depends on the patient, their situation, their age, their family history, the constellation of symptoms. But if someone had red flag symptoms for colon cancer, then one of the tests we want to be thinking about eventually, of course, is a colonoscopy test. And, you know, we've heard from my patient earlier about that, because that is the gold standard way of checking out the colon, of seeing if there's anything growing in there that shouldn't be, seeing if there's any polyps. And one of the great advantages of colonoscopy, as we heard, is if you see anything precancerous during the procedure, you can remove it there and then. So it's not just having a look, it's actually doing something practical. Now, depending on other things, we may want to be doing some blood tests, we may want to be doing some poop tests. It really depends. It's really, really individualized on that particular person. But if we're at all worried about colon cancer, then a colonoscopy is going to be the gold standard test.
Dr. Neil, is there anything that in this last half hour you feel like we haven't touched on that is really important to raise awareness of? Any facts or numbers that you'd like to communicate today to really bring this message home to people listening?
So, okay, important take-home messages, I guess, are be aware of your risk of colon cancer, know about your family history, particularly if there's a first-degree relative, know about lifestyle things that can make a difference, not only to your colon health, but also your overall health, and be aware of symptoms. But most importantly is, even if you're well, even if you've got no family history, still, once you get to a certain age, come and have a chat about screening, because it can potentially save your life.
Dr. Neil, thank you so much for your time today. Dr. Neil speaking to us, consultant in gastroenterology and hepatology at Health Bay Clinic.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
I love a busy studio, not one but two guests in with me until 5 o'clock today. We are live on Dubai Eye 103.8 and continuing the conversations around Autism Awareness Month. Although I have to say, having welcomed a few different guests with different perspectives, we've been talking about not just awareness, but also acceptance, also advocacy, celebration. And joining us in the studio today, we've got a husband and wife team. We've got Farah, aka That Autism Coach, and husband Danesh, who goes by autism.dad on Instagram. How are you both?
Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much. Really, really appreciate your time. Farah, you've said that you've lived with autism for 33 years.
That's right.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
Okay. I was born in Dubai and my brother was on the spectrum. He is still on the spectrum. And we had no idea what autism meant. There was not even a term clearly defined what autism exactly means. And pediatricians, well-meaning pediatricians who are family friends, would come and try to help us understand the diagnosis because they're learning themselves what it is. And so there wasn't much help. We didn't know where to go. And people around us would look, would judge, and our lives changed because, again, there was no awareness. And we didn't know what autism was.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. You know, this has been such an you know, and rightly so, evolving conversation over the last few years. But decades ago, when you haven't got that information, it becomes something to fear. And whether that is within the family or, as you're saying, you know, in the community, people were reacting. Would you mind explaining in terms of behaviours, you know, what did you and the family start to kind of clue into that perhaps he was on the spectrum?
Delayed speech was the main one. And when we put him into the nursery, the teacher said he's different. That's all she said, that he's different. He's not like the other kids and you should get this checked. We didn't know exactly what we were getting checked. But yes, of course, he was hyper. He was extremely hyper. He wouldn't listen. He wouldn't follow instructions. And then he had intellectual disability as well.
We've got Farah with us today. Dinesh, as I said, you go by autism.dad on Instagram. Tell us a little bit about why you chose that username. And I guess perhaps a little bit on the impact that fathers in particular can have in this space.
So back to your question, the way that I got that name is honestly because I thought somebody already had it. So when I put it in Instagram, I thought, oh, come on, somebody's already going to have autism dad. So I put it in. Nobody had it. So they're off.
Take it.
Awesome, right? So I just put the dot in, get in there. And honestly, it started because I was doing so much work with Suleiman on a daily basis and stuff. And I and Suleiman had a different relationship where we were more fun. Farah was the educator, the academic, the therapist. I was just a fun dad and stuff. So I started posting things that I did with him. And then the more I kind of got into the social universe, I started realizing that there was so much negativity about it. And I started becoming more and more open. Like, we were always very open about Suleiman's autism. We'd discuss it with friends and family, and we'd be very clear about, you know, our situation. And I noticed that that was not the case. And somebody once told me something really interesting. They said, if you can talk about something, you must talk about it. And so the idea was that, you know, right now there's 1 in 36 children with, you know, globally, the statistic is different, but roughly with autism. That means in your circle of 5 friends, somebody must have either heard of or knows somebody on the spectrum. But honestly, most people say, I can't really remember. That's not because they're not there. It's just because they're not being discussed. And so I said, if I start discussing this, the idea is that I want to make it such a, I want to bring it to the mainstream so that before that statistic is 1 in 10 kids, selfishly, my child, Suleiman, lives in a society where it's acceptable to have autism.
I love that.
And so that's actually where it started from.
And your Instagram is such a joyful place. It's really, really good fun, Dinesh. It really is.
Well, that's the other thing. There is just so much negativity out there. Yeah. And my thing was, look, we all have good days and bad days. Right? I'm just not going to post on my bad days. I'm going to post on my good days.
We've got Farah and Dinesh with us today. They have 4 children. The oldest, Suleiman, is on the spectrum. We're going to find out a little bit more about family life, about how Dubai has evolved around this conversation too, to become more autism friendly. We've had a number of questions coming in the text line too. We've had questions about what they think of the Sunflower Lanyard program, tips, and this is a great one for you guys, any tips on dealing with siblings of an autistic child. Up next, Farah is an autism coach. But what does that mean? We'll find out. Farah, aka That Autism Coach, and husband Dinesh, who goes by autism.dad on Instagram, joining us. They have 4 kids. Their oldest, Suleiman, is a teenager, is on the spectrum. And I wanted to ask about, I guess, the role that he has played on shaping your career, Farah, because you are an autism coach. Tell us a little bit about what you do and why.
I have a special education background. It all started with me working with Suleiman, obviously, and that's why I learned. Then I started working with other kids, and the more I worked with kids, Helen, I realized that it wasn't really the kids that needed the help. It was the families, because no matter how much effort you put into the child, how much you work on yourself as a teacher, regulate yourself so that you can sit with the child who's got behavioral problems, he goes back home, he comes back the next day completely dysregulated again. So I changed my stance, obviously, and I changed my direction. I was like, okay, it's some mothers who need help because they're managing the temperature of the house. So, and the more I spoke to mothers, the more I realized how overwhelmed they were with the information and the societal pressure that everything had to be maintained a certain way. And because of that, they just didn't have the headspace to work with their children or to be around their children. And so as a coach, that's what I started doing. I'm also an NLP practitioner and a brain gym movement facilitator. So I teach moms on how to use simple movements at home that they can use easily. They don't have to go to an OT for that. They can do it at home in the comfort of their own home and regulate themselves so that they can be around their children.
So putting things in their toolkit that they can call on and be
exactly
responsive rather than reactive.
Exactly.
Okay, that must be so
valuable.
That
makes a big difference. Yeah, because the kids come to school better. You know, they're ready to learn.
We had a really interesting message that I'd like to put to both of you. Anonymous message on 4001, and that is absolutely fine, saying, hi both, any tips on dealing with siblings of an autistic child? Our daughter is clearly quite jealous of the quote-unquote special treatment, appointment, time that her older brother requires. We make a huge effort to have family time, take her out alone, but it never feels enough. She's 12 and he's 14. And as you said earlier, it's not just about working with the child, it's it's the whole family. Dinesh, anything that comes to mind with this listener in particular?
I can only say what I do. So the way that I look at it is that I've told the kids, look, Suleiman and his siblings are like Batman and Robin. Some days he's Batman, some days you're Batman, right? The point is that siblings always provide love and support. And the way that I've explained to them is I've changed their mindset from a very young age in the idea that, look, of all of the 6 to 8 billion people on the planet, God could have sent this child anywhere. But he chose you as a sister and you as a brother and me as a father, right? Now, he has sent something that's not quite perfect for this world, right? So it's really delicate and fragile. And he has selected you to take care of this thing, right? So you as a sister, you as a brother, me as a father. So we're special in the sense that we've been given this thing. So I've kind of made it into this thing where, oh, I'm special for having a brother with sibling, right? So I do tell them, look, someone's always going to need some attention from you, some from me. And that's just, you know, it is what it is. But I think I do give time to the other siblings. So I'll say, look, you know, just you and me, we'll go out for ice cream.
And I think it's really important to label it as time together.
Right.
This is an afternoon for just us.
Just
us. You know, if it's you and me for the next hour.
But at the end of the day, the child has got to grow up understanding that if this is a shared responsibility. This is not dad or mom's responsibility. I want them to grow up saying, you know, Suleiman, you know, is part of my family. It's something that I have responsibility for because I'm special. God's chosen me for this mission along with my dad and stuff. So that's the way that I have kind of set in their brain. And it's something that you do young enough. So like my youngest, Mariam, was seven. And she used to go out and say, oh, yeah, my brother's like autistic. You know, she was very open about it because we were open about it. And this one particular incident, we were in a school and the kids had a science fair. And so Suleiman went in and he is, you know, it's loud there, right? So Suleiman's got these sound sensitivities. So he goes and sits quietly and he's got his hands like this. Mariam and Mustafa are there. I'm checking out Mustafa's project. Mariam sees it, leaves her friends, goes there, and I see her tapping his shoulder. Mind you, she's 8 and a half, and she's tapping his shoulder. I picked up my phone, I took a picture, and I said, you know what? This is what empathy looks like, to get up from your friends and say, let me just, a hand on the shoulder is all you need.
Oh, excuse me, goosebumps. Farah and Dinesh in the studio today. We've had all sorts of really interesting insights and questions. And Dinesh is saying there, you know, about the world not being, well, The way you phrased it actually was that, you know, not perfect for this world, but maybe the world needs to change. And I certainly feel that Dubai is changing. That's what we're going to be addressing next. Farah, born and raised here in the UAE. So how has Dubai become more autism friendly? We're also taking any questions that you might have. Maybe want to share experiences of what has been really positive here going with your child, or indeed you want to give a bit of a question for our guests. Sophia saying, what a wonderful family. What do they think of the Sunflower Lanyard programme? We'll find out. We've also had questions about misdiagnosis. And also Libby saying, which attractions or facilities would they say are autism friendly? You've got some friends moving. Their son is autistic. He's age 8 and I think they are a bit nervous. Joining us in studio, we've got husband and wife team, Farah and Danish, with us today. Farah is a coach. She's an NLP practitioner. Danish goes by Autism Dad on Instagram. They've got 4 children. Their oldest, Suleiman, 16, is on the spectrum and has very much informed both the social media, but also a little bit about how they work with the world, work with other families. I wanted to ask you about different ages and stages bringing challenges, Farah. You work with families, you know, all the way through from getting initial diagnosis to really offering some very valuable support and advocating for families. Are there any, you know, milestones or moments that you've noticed, you know, as well as being a sister of someone on the spectrum, where you think, okay, this could be a tricky time for you?
There's just so much information out there, right? I mean, in terms of my brother being diagnosed with autism, and I told you about the struggles we had with understanding and accepting the diagnosis, and thinking about, okay, early intervention, but which way do you go with this? Mm-hmm. How do you start? Where do you start? And you're growing up at a time where there is really no knowledge and acceptance and awareness about it. So, and this is in the 90s, Helen. We've had some really awkward, embarrassing situations while growing up. And it was very stressful as siblings because we would shy away from family gatherings, from public spaces. We just didn't think our house was open to having people over.
So you started to lead
we
a
started
smaller
to close
life.
In. Yes, yes. So there's a lot of trauma still about, you know, our childhood and all, everything that was associated with autism. Mm-hmm. We've had situations where the police have been called in. And at that time, there was, again, no awareness. He was growing up, my brother. He was around 15 years old, 16 years old. And he'd say something to someone and that someone doesn't understand what is autism, even though we tell them. And at the heat of the moment, nobody's listening that this person, this individual has a problem, give him some space. Nobody's understanding. They're just immediately calling the police. So in terms of, you know, while he was growing, we saw all this happening, but we just didn't know how to, you know, grapple with the situation, how to keep changing and evolving as a family. Mm-hmm. We had no idea. But how that has helped us with my son is that I can see that now. I can see that if I don't take these steps now, that's what's going to happen, because my brother, who's now 33 years old, he has a lot of mental issues now, which we're struggling, which he needs psychiatric help with, because he didn't get that help mm-hmm. at that stage.
So you're really being proactive and empowering people to understand.
That's where it's going to go if you don't take these steps now. And as a family, if you don't understand the sibling dynamics, which we just discussed, mm-hmm. it's going to become a very toxic place for all your kids and for yourself.
Now, it's very hard to talk about autism because it's so, I mean, the word spectrum is used, you know, and you've met one autistic child. But we were speaking to Adam, the OT, occupational therapist, a few weeks ago, and one of the messages that came in was about how one family's son is a teenager now, and he is very rough. And it was a male listener who got in touch saying, I'm really worried about how my wife and our nanny are going to be able to care for him. And your boy's a teenager now. And I guess that when I'm thinking about different ages and stages, you know, hormones in the mix, things can get a bit more complicated, I'm guessing.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, with Suleiman, one of the things that I propagate to parents that are looking into therapy is there are so many things you can do at home. Mm-hmm. So when your child, particularly in your teens, get them on a regular exercise regimen. And it's simple. You don't need to hire a private coach. You're going to do the basics. You're going to do squats and lunges. You're going to run a little bit. You're going to do some weights. particularly a lot of children on the spectrum have low muscle tone. So you're going to need to build some strength training into their system. And it's really basic stuff. You can get a trainer to come and do tell you one time and make a program, and you can follow it up every day. Mm-hmm. Getting that exercise regulates their mood.
Really important pillar.
It's incredibly important. So when parents are like, you know, he's having a meltdown or something, I'm like, is he eating the right foods, right? Did you feed him chicken nuggets and french fries? Oh, he's really picky. I get that. I totally understand that. But diet and nutrition is one of the biggest themes on my Instagram profile. The diet and nutrition you can do on your own. Mm-hmm. Any therapy per hour is roughly, you're looking at in Dubai or anywhere, 500 dirhams a session. And they will easily say, oh, your kid needs about 20 sessions a month. Do the math. It's incredible. But diet and nutrition is something you can do at home really easily. It has to be home cooked. It shouldn't be processed. And just an hour of exercise a day. So the answer to your question, when these kids are growing up, as they're getting older, the father needs to be there. And exercise needs to be a regular thing so they can get that out of their system and regulate their mood.
Those fundamentals, those pillars. Sophia's messaged in saying, what a wonderful family. What do they think of the Sunflower Lanyard program? So this is something I've seen, I think, at the airport. Is that right?
That's right.
So can you explain it for anyone that's not familiar?
Well, we didn't actually get a chance to use it yet, but when we did fly in last year, we just went to the officials. We told them about our son's, condition.
Actually, we had a delay. There was a huge line. There was a huge queue. So I just went up to the official at the counter and said, listen, my son's got autism and standing in a line as a family together is going to be really difficult. He immediately just said, oh, autism? No problem. He took the entire family, found a space for us and said, listen, you want something? I'll go to the departure lounge and I'll get something to eat or you can come with me. I told Farah, I said, we've never experienced the lanyard ourselves, but the lanyard's just a symbol. And if you reach out to government today, whether it's immigration, police, at the airport, and you just say, listen, I've got a child on spectrum or POD, man, they respond like that.
We had a message from Libby, which I thought was a really interesting point, because I feel like Dubai has really adapted and improved to work with, to help families with autistic children in recent years. And Libby's saying, are there any attractions or facilities that your guests would say are autism friendly in Dubai? Some friends are moving here next month. Their son is autistic, age 8, and I think they're a bit nervous. What comes to mind, Farah?
Well, for us, it's been most of the theme parks over here. So whenever we go as a family, we get express service. And I think even the cinemas over here, you have that option of letting them know that, your child is on the spectrum and they provide whatever help is needed. So that just makes it easier for us as a family to go out and enjoy.
And a big change to what you were saying earlier about, when you were growing up with your brother, kind of closing the wagons around the family and leading a smaller life because of other people's judgments and perceptions and the practicalities around it as well. Dinesh, anywhere or anyone you want to give a shout out to? You mentioned, great experiences at the airport as well. But for those family-friendly activities, anything that comes to mind in particular?
Like Farah said, the theme parks are fantastic. I think the thing to be wary about is they do require you to have some identification that the child is personal determination. I remember a time when Magic Planet at Dera City Center was so cool that I'd go there and I'd say, oh, Suleiman's just autistic. And they wouldn't ask a thing. And he'd be like, all right. And he'd be in the bounce house for like hours. No biggie. But now they're like, we need the beauty card. I do think there is a system in the Dubai government where if you're coming in as a tourist, that you can register your child as a tourist, as a POD, and they give you something and you get tons of benefits from that. So definitely something for them to check out.
A lot of people did write in asking for coming and just, visiting Dubai. And I tell them, they'd go back and they're like, we've had the best vacation ever. Everything was just so easy. And anything we wanted, we were, taken care of immediately.
That's
so
really wonderful.
It's nice
to
hear that.
Farah, if our conversation over the last hour has encourage someone to reach out to you. As I said, maybe they want someone to talk to, someone to guide them. What's the best way of reaching out to you, whether it's in person or online?
You can get in touch with me through my Instagram page, which is Ask Farah Now, or on by email, farah@farahdanish.com. That's the easiest way to get to. Yeah.
And as I said earlier, we've got autism.dad on Instagram, very, very fun corner of the internet. Guys, thank you so much for coming in. I think it's been wonderful to hear from, you know, your professional experiences, but also as a family as well. So, so valuable. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.